And welcome to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, CKUT.ca around the world. And I am here remotely with Doug, and we're taking a look at a few different things. Chad, big news out of Chad, just got through highly controversial elections that re-elected the leader who had been, well, quote unquote, re-elected the leader who had been in power for 30 years, only to have him killed. A few days later. So we're going to take a look at that and what the implications of that are. And Doug, you pulled together some stuff from the conversation. Why don't you introduce that?
Well, the conversation has become one of my go-to news sources because of its credibility. We'll talk about it a little bit later, but they have done also podcasts or have started doing podcasts. And this one, just this week that came out, is a very useful and insightful look at the problems of kidnapping in northern Nigeria, with several very informed people from Nigeria bringing us into the picture about the what's going on there. And then they move very smoothly across the continent to Kenya and talk about why women, some are being kidnapped and coerced into joining Al-Shabaab, but others join quite willingly. And a researcher in Mombasa gives her insights to all of that. So stay tuned to Amanda.
And now for our entertainment news. African bad girl Tiwa Savage is on the front page again.
Welcome back to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM. For the best of Amanda, please visit our blog at amanda.ca. So Doug, tell us a little bit more about the conversation and what you're going to be bringing us tonight.
Well, the conversation is, as I say, is one of my go-to places to find information these days. It's about 4 or 5 years old now, started in Australia by a couple of independent journalists. It's independent, high quality, authenticated, explanatory journalism. And its aim is to underpin a functioning democracy by bringing a better understanding of current affairs and complex issues, and hopefully allow for a better quality of public discourse and conversations. They depend on donations, so they're not sponsored by big companies or anybody else. And their writers are very often academics, people with long experience in the field. They always put the person's picture, their provenance, which institution they're connected to, and even put a little proviso or waiver saying this author has no sponsorship from any interests that are involved in this, right, except for, or this author has had a research grant for studying this from such and such an organization. So it's always pretty clear,
transparent
about what you're getting. And mm-hmm. and I find the articles, some are extremely long and quite complex. Others are very nice, snappy, pointed, short interviews. For instance, there's a recent one out, and this is important for everyone, malaria. There's some real mm-hmm. advances on malaria vaccine, yeah, and they do a really interesting article in their podcast and articles this time. But I was more interested in what popped up about the background, and it's the Nigerian correspondent for them. This is by the Conversation UK, and the Nigerian correspondent contacted two very articulate and well read people about the situation in northern Nigeria and why the kidnapping's going on. What are the forces at work, including, of course, that the country is not serving that region very well at all. So, you know, they always blame intergroup conflicts. Well, yes, there are intergroup conflicts. It's mm-hmm. the desert and climate change pushing the nomads down, and they're coming into conflict with other groups. And of course, the whole Libya thing is back in the background, and the government failure to provide basic services even to its people up there that are driving these kinds of problems. So that was good. And then the other is this article from Nigeria, from Kenya, a university professor they introduce all of these people, so I'm not going to do it, in Mombasa, who talks about Al-Shabaab and why and how women are recruited, and some join very willingly while others are forced, coerced, and the role they end up playing. So let's listen to the conversation.
Hello and welcome to The Conversation Weekly. I'm Gemma Ware in London, and for this episode, I'm joined by my colleague Wale Fetade in Lagos, Nigeria. Hello, Wale.
Hi, Gemma. Good to be with you.
This week, why insurgent groups in northern Nigeria continue to kidnap schoolchildren.
And why the government has been unable to improve the security situation in the region.
They use the children to negotiate during conflicts.
And we speak to a researcher who has interviewed Kenyan women about why they joined the militant group Al-Shabaab.
So because you're not strong as an individual, now you feel like joining the Al-Shabaab.
You're listening to The Conversation Weekly, the world explained by experts.
Gemma, today I'm going to take you to Nigeria.
Wale, where are we talking to you from?
I'm talking to you from Lagos, but today we are going to talk about the north, specifically the northeastern part of Nigeria.
And what's it like in the north?
The north used to be very beautiful. We have partly desert, partly savannah. You can stand in a particular location and see farther, farther, far without any structure obstructing your view, like the forest that you have in the south. But now it's been pretty scary these days because now it's a scene of banditry, kidnapping and terrorist attacks.
And we're talking today about children in particular. So what's it like being a child growing up in this part of Nigeria in the north?
Children used to roam around and move freely. But now to be a child in the northeastern part of Nigeria is more likely to be kidnapped, abducted or taken away in the classroom or on the way to school.
Are children still being kidnapped?
Oh, yes. We had an incident in December last year where 333 students were kidnapped.
More than 300 students are missing after gunmen on motorcycles stormed a government school in Kankara, Katsina State.
Some days later, another batch of students were kidnapped from an Islamic school in Mauta, too, in Katsina State.
It happened early hours, and they got the distress call last night. And
early this year, in February, 27 students were abducted in Kagara, Niger State.
27 students have been kidnapped, and then one student was shot dead, unfortunately, during the operation.
Some days later, 317 schoolgirls were abducted in Yangebe.
The government says gunmen on motorcycles stormed a state-run boarding school, kidnapping hundreds of children.
And some days later, at the Federal College of Forestry and Agriculture, some students were kidnapped. As at now, 29 of them are still being held captive by these kidnappers.
And even this week, there's been another attack, hasn't there?
Yeah, there has been another attack in a town called Damasak in Borno State.
Up to 100,000 Damasak residents are fleeing to Niger Republic,
which has witnessed several attacks. People have been chased away from their homes, and some people were killed. I think about 8 people.
And so who is behind these attacks?
It used to be Boko Haram. It's a terror group that is known for abduction, known for trying to prevent children from going to school. And it loosely translates, book is forbidden. That is, anything Western education is not something that they are in support of. But now that has metamorphosed into Islamic State in West Africa, ISWAP, as they are called. And then there are also other groups kidnapping for money. And these are the people that the Nigerian media loosely refer to as bandits.
And so for this episode, you've been speaking to some experts about what's been happening, right?
Yeah, you're correct. I've been speaking to 2 experts to find out more about why children are being targeted by insurgent groups, including Boko Haram and all these other groups. And then also the challenges the Nigerian government faces now in improving security in the northern part of the country.
I'm Hakeem Onapaju. I'm a senior lecturer in the Department of Political Science and International Relations at Nine University of Nigeria, that's in Abuja.
Hakeem's research focuses on the northeast of Nigeria and the neighboring region surrounding Lake Chad.
I've researched extensively on the problem of Boko Haram in the northeastern part of the country. So we're talking about Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, Niger Republic. These are the areas that are more affected by the activities of the terrorists.
He says that civilians have borne much of the brunt of the conflict involving Boko Haram. The militant organization wants to overthrow the government of President Muhammadu Buhari and create an Islamic State.
Civilians have been a major casualty in the whole violence in that particular region. About 16,000 people have been killed, and we've had over 2 million people that have been displaced.
Recently, Hakeem's research has turned to look at the impact the conflict in northern Nigeria has had on the most vulnerable children. He's recently published a new research in the journal African Security on the issue and has just written an article about it for The Conversation.
I was able to discover that the conflict has a huge impact on the welfare and security of children in that area. A UN report showed that almost 4,000 children were killed between 2015 and 2016, that's just in 1 year. And while we have about 7,000 of them injured in various attacks.
Children have been caught right in the middle of the conflict and have as a result often suffered the most.
As a result of suicide attacks, as a result of air and ground strikes, as a result of extrajudicial killing by state security forces, especially on suspicions of being suicide bombers.
Many of those who survive attacks are then displaced from their homes by the conflict.
UNICEF reports that about 57% of the total 2 million people, those who are affected as internally displaced people in the IDP camps, are children. You have about 244,000 of them suffering from severe malnutrition. And worse still, it's estimated that about 49,000 of them would die if there was no emergency treatment. So it's a serious situation that we have in that part of the region. And the more worrisome aspect of it is the massive recruitment of children as child soldiers in that area.
While the conflict has only received international attention in the past 5 to 6 years, Boko Haram's activities go back at least until 2009.
The activities of the group have been there for some time in terms of missionary activities.
The general consensus among researchers is that the group's mostly missionary activities were peaceful.
The menace of Boko Haram actually started in 2009 when the group had a clash with state security agencies.
In the clashes, the Nigerian government killed an estimated 800 Boko Haram members, including the leader, Mohammed Yusuf.
Mohammed Yusuf died in police custody just hours after security forces said they had captured him in the city of Maiduguri. Police troops had stormed Boko Haram's stronghold.
Following the attack, the group retaliated under its new leader, Abubakar Shekau, by launching an insurgency campaign against the Nigerian state.
They started by targeting security officials or anything that has a semblance or has a figure of the state.
But soon, the group shifted its focus to target civilians.
Later, they were seeking means to gain international attention, so they moved towards attacking civilians because they are actually the vulnerable groups in the society. Now, civilians constitute one of their major targets.
And gradually, Boko Haram militants began targeting children.
They started by going to dormitories, boarding houses, schools, to attack the children.
A staggering report from the United Nations Children's Fund says one in five suicide bombers used by the terror group is a child.
We use as suicide bombers then, and if you look at the gender dimensions, their penchant to go after girls. They also use them as domestic slaves to work for them in their camps. They use them as sex slaves. They rape them.
Eventually, Boko Haram garnered international attention in 2014 when he kidnapped 276 girls in Borno State in a place called Chibok.
Female students were abducted from a school in northeastern Nigeria the day it happened in the town of Chibok.
The group was relatively unknown before their kidnap of the Chibok girls. And immediately after the kidnap, there was this global campaign for the release of the children, the Bring Back Our Girls campaign.
The international community is building pressure on the government of Nigeria to intensify efforts to locate the more than 250 schoolgirls kidnapped.
High-profile politicians and celebrities, including then First Lady Michelle Obama, came forward posting pictures of themselves on social media, holding up banners that said, "Bring back our girls."
Let us all pray for their safe return. Let us hold their families in our hearts.
International efforts to rescue the girls involved the intervention of the Human Security Division of the Swiss government's foreign ministry and the Red Cross. Between 2016 and 2021, some 100 of the Chibok girls were freed in exchange for about $3.7 million in ransoms. Of the remaining 176, some have escaped or died, and at least 100 girls are still believed to be living in Boko Haram's captivity. Hakim says it was this reaction from the international community that led Boko Haram to kidnap the girls in the first place.
So that itself popularized the group, and besides that, they can also use that to negotiate for some ransom in order to fund their operations. So these are some of the reasons why children are very strategic to their activities.
There are other reasons why Boko Haram continues to kidnap children.
They use the children to negotiate during conflict for the release of their members that have been in prisons. Because of the emotional aspect of children, they feel the government would easily listen to them.
But Boko Haram is just one of the many insurgent groups in Nigeria. Across the country, conflicts and armed groups are threatening the lives of Nigerians, such as the conflict in the West between Fulani herdsmen and Yoruba farmers.
Herdsmen and farmers have been locked in a violent conflict. The most recent clashes saw 73 people killed.
And security issues are not confined to the northeast of the country. Bandits and other armed groups like the Islamic State in West Africa have begun doing copycat kidnappings in the northwest of the country, most recently in Zamfara State, when 300 schoolgirls were kidnapped and released a few days later in early March.
Gunmen in Nigeria have abducted several hundred schoolgirls in what is the latest mass kidnapping in the region. The abduction happened at a boarding school in the town.
Earlier this month in April, a prison in Nigeria's southeast in the town of Owerri was attacked by members of a new armed insurrection.
Gunmen have freed more than 1,800 inmates from a prison in southeastern Nigeria.
The gunmen share no affiliation or ideological interest with Boko Haram.
Nigerian police believe a banned separatist group, the indigenous people of Biafra, was behind the attack.
Whether it's Boko Haram or other insurgent groups, this all points to a much larger question around security in Nigeria. To understand more about what the government has been doing to improve the situation, I reach out to Samuel Okunade.
The state of insecurity in Nigeria is rife. Currently, there's still killings, banditry, and of course, kidnapping.
Samuel is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pretoria, South Africa, where he researches the government's response to the attacks by Boko Haram and how communities in the northeast of Nigeria have dealt with the conflict.
Constant attacks being carried out by the insurgent group built my curiosity to finding out the coping strategies which they've been able to evolve over the years to ensure their continued survival within those communities.
Samuel's research focuses on communities living near Nigeria's borders.
We can also call these places borderlands. So these are communities that you find on the borders between two independent states. And when you look at the way Boko Haram carry out their attacks, at times, they live in in some communities on the other side of the border. So when they come into Nigeria, they have to come in through these border communities. So they come into these communities that will to carry out their attacks, burn down houses, kill people, kidnap people.
As part of his work, Samuel focused on six border communities in 2017 and 2018 in the northeastern states of Borno, Adamawa, and Yobe, where he looked at the Nigerian military's response to the attacks by Boko Haram.
I discovered that the Nigerian government, which is supposed to be the major player, the key stakeholder, has failed in its responsibility of combating the menace of the Boko Haram within that region and within the country at large. And that's why the Boko Haram still continue to grow in leap and bound till date, and they still continue to carry out attacks within the region. And gradually, the attention is shifting to the bandits in the northwestern part of Nigeria.
Samuel says this all points to the fact that there is a high rate of insecurity in Nigeria.
And it's not just the Boko Haram alone now. It has spilled to the southern part of Nigeria. When we look away from the northeastern region of Nigeria and we look into the northwestern part, a lot of people have lost their lives to banditry, kidnapping, clashes between the farmers and the elders within that region.
But by far, the biggest security threat continues to be Boko Haram. Until 2010, the Nigerian government had largely ignored the security conditions in northeast Nigeria.
The Nigerian government was pushed to respond. And this only happened when the United States blacklisted the Nigerian state for terrorism in January 2010.
The U.S. put Nigeria on a countries of interest list. It requires.
Samuel is referring here to the use of a directive issued by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in 2010, which placed Nigeria on the U.S. terror watch list alongside other so-called countries of interest. The measure effectively meant that citizens from countries including Nigeria, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Somalia who traveled to the U.S. was subjected to enhanced background checks and interrogation techniques at U.S. airports. As a result of the blacklisting, a diplomatic row ensued. Nigeria's Minister of Information, Professor Dora Akunyili, described the move as unfair and discriminatory, while Foreign Affairs Minister then, Chief Ojo Madueke, said the new security measures by the U.S. targeted at Nigerians is an unacceptable New Year gift.
Some say it's a terrorist, some say no, it's country of interest. We think the whole idea of country of interest is a euphemism. It's a distinction without a difference. We don't like to be on that list.
But Samuel says it was this designation of Nigeria as a country of interest that eventually spurred the government in Abuja into action the year after.
They decided to work on an anti-terrorism legislation, and that was what led to the Terrorism Prevention Act, which was signed into law in June 2011. Shortly after, the president then decided to form a special joint task force called JTF to respond. At the initial stage, it was composed of 30,000 troops, and they were mobilized into the northeastern state, especially the troubled areas, to combat the attacks of the Boko Haram.
The joint task force, made up of both members of the military and the Nigerian police force, coordinates intelligence and supports the Nigerian security forces and the fight against the insurgents. While initially focusing mainly on localized counter-insurgency campaigns, its remit has expanded progressively over the years. In addition to armed protection of communities under attack by Boko Haram, members of the Joint Task Force have more recently been tasked with providing security to displaced populations living in camps for internally displaced people. But Samuel says much of the current strategy depends on regional and international support.
At a point, they got support from within Africa and from beyond. They got support for training, they got intelligence support, and they were also supported in terms of arms and ammunition, which were donated to them by various countries of the world. And some of them even sent down troops to support in the fight against the Boko Haram.
But the government's strategy wasn't working.
The Boko Haram still continued to grow, and they still continue to carry out attacks within that region. The lackadaisical attitude being shown towards the fight against insurgency has impeded or has prevented the Nigerian government from successfully fighting the menace of insurgency within the region.
He says this is because the Joint Task Force is often overpowered by the insurgents who carry superior arms and use guerrilla tactics in their attacks.
The government has failed to adequately coordinate these huge resources available to them to be able to fight and combat the Boko Haram menace. When you look at the reality, the kind of weapon the military or the JTF carry is far, far, far less than what the force they are fighting is carrying.
Part of the reason the government has been unable to coordinate an effective response, Samuel says, is widespread corruption.
Corruption has eaten deep into the fabrics of the Nigerian state. And that is the reason why we earmark so much money to purchase arms and ammunition. And then at the end of the day, you discover that nothing has been purchased in the fight against this insurgency.
As a result of the corruption, many Nigerian soldiers have had to survive on meager or often unpaid salaries.
They are being treated like slaves in their own country. And that's the situation of the soldiers. We don't have basic things to keep us going. And what are those basic things? Water, food. It's so alarming that people who are risking their lives for their country would lack this kind of things. So if they lack food, if they lack water, then we won't be surprised that they would lack the needed firearm to combat the Boko Haram within that region.
Another part of the problem is that the Joint Task Force has allegedly engaged in unlawful killings, arrests, extortion, and intimidation.
They've been killing the local people indiscriminately, especially the youth and the men. And as a result of that, the people have lost trust in them. And you can see how the fight against insurgency within that region has dragged up to date, to a point in which we now have another group in the northwest coming up now and carrying out kidnappings and all that.
In the interview Samuel conducted for his research with people living in the border communities, he found that many had felt neglected by the government, leaving them to fend for themselves.
There is this lady, she's called Aisha Bakari Gombi. She's leading a force in Borno State to counter the attacks of the Boko Haram in some of the border communities, to see to the release of kidnapped children, women, by the Boko Haram. Today we can say that some of them can happily return to their farms and to live in those communities again, although they still have to be very conscious on the environment when they move around, because it's still pretty dangerous for them.
Akeem Onapaju told me that the issue goes beyond the government's failure to protect its population, but that in some cases, the state is complicit in using children.
The state-supported militia group, that's the CJTF, Civilian Joint Task Force, both of them are using children to fight in that particular region. So according to UN estimate, for example, about 8,000 children are presently child soldiers in that region.
I asked Akeem what he thought the government strategy should be to protect communities from attacks against insurgents and to stop more children from being kidnapped.
Number one, government has to have a new approach towards addressing the insecurity in the country. You know, it's apparent that the approach has not been working. Security in the country, especially in that region, there should be much more commitment to international collaborations in addressing the problem of that area. There should be much more provision of the needed equipment for the soldiers to fight this particular group. And also there should be much more focus on the non-military approaches towards addressing the problem. You know, there are root causes behind the reign of terror in that region. I think much more focus should be on how to introduce programs that will prevent the easy recruitment and attacks on children in that region.
And he says the government needs to start prioritizing children.
When I wrote my article, someone commented that why should we be talking about child security? Why not talk about general security? But the answer to that is that children have some of their peculiar interests, and children are much more vulnerable. So the government must find a way to provide special security at places where children are actually located, in schools, in IDP camps, in their homes.
Samuel warned that unless the government rebuilds the trust with communities living in the shadow of Boko Haram, these communities will find other solutions to keep themselves safe.
So one of the coping strategies which I found out in some of the communities, many of them have gone into alliance with the Boko Haram in terms of negotiation for security. And every month they give out groceries to them. They give out whatever the agreement is in exchange for security. When the lives of your citizens are not being protected, then people will lose trust in your government. And that's exactly what we are witnessing presently in Nigeria. So the Nigerian state has to stand up to its responsibility of protecting lives and properties of the people.
Thank you, Wale, for digging into the history of all that and how complex it is and how big a task it is for the government to really protect these communities. It sounds like it's a real challenge.
Seriously, the government must up its game in responding to all these attacks.
Our listeners can read more from Hakim Onopajo and Samuel Okunadi about their research in some articles that they've written for The Conversation, which we're going to be putting links to in our show notes.
Also, they can find out more about banditry in Nigeria and the young people being drawn into it in a recent interview I did with Sheryl Folarin at Covenant University for our podcast, Pasha. The link is in the show notes too.
Do go listen, everyone, to Pasha. It's a great show.
And now we are crossing the continent from west to east for our second story today to hear about some new research in Kenya about another Islamist group, Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab is a militant group based in Somalia where it's in a kind of violent stalemate with the Somali government and a coalition of foreign peacekeeping troops. From its bases in Somalia, Al-Shabaab continues to recruit people from the coastal region of neighbouring Kenya, including women. To find out more about these women and the complex dynamics surrounding their involvement in Al-Shabaab, I called up Fatima Azmia Badudin in Mombasa to talk about the interviews that she's been doing with some of these women.
I'm Fatima Azmia. I work at the Department of Social Sciences, Technical University of Mombasa in Kenya. My study focuses on recruitment of women and girls into extremist networks such as the Al-Shabaab.
And where am I speaking to you from today?
From Kenya. I'm based in Mombasa.
Can you explain to our listeners who are Al-Shabaab and what is their kind of goal and what do they want as an organization?
Al-Shabaab, a transnational terrorist network. It originates in Somalia. It's mainly a Somali-based militant, I could say, insurgency group. And it spreads its influence in most of the East African regions and even beyond. So ideology is mainly to have a caliphate in the East African region. The primary areas of operation are Somalia, Kenya, Djibouti, Tanzania, Uganda, even today to a level like Mozambique.
We're talking in March 2021, and Al-Shabaab has been in existence since the early 2000s. How much territory does it have, and what's the kind of balance of power between it and the Somali government?
They have their bases. Today, too, we have a particular, we call it a sort of a transition government, but still Al-Shabaab becomes very strong in the southern areas, mainly because of his tax bases, their control.
Okay, so they're more powerful along the southern part of Somalia, which is actually bordering Kenya. Your research is focused on coastal Kenya and kind of the northern bit of Kenya, where we're going down towards Mombasa, which is in the south of the country. Can you explain to me what kind of the dynamics are of this area that you research?
So my study is based on the coastal region of Kenya. This includes areas like Lamu, Kwale, Mombasa, Kilifi. Kenya becomes a conducive ground for recruitment from this transnational extremist movement due to the prevailing pockets of marginalized communities and also deprived situations, the broken state-citizen relationships, youth unemployment, and also some underdeveloped areas. But today the trends are changing from what it was before. So it's not only the coast, but we also have other areas which are vulnerable for radicalization and recruitment.
And your focus has been predominantly on women being recruited into the Al-Shabaab. Can you explain why is Al-Shabaab trying to recruit women?
So like many other terrorist organizations or insurgency networks, Al-Shabaab also uses women and girls. This is not something very new. But the main reason why Al-Shabaab had this trend emanating is because of women's important roles and the need for their role in tactical operations. Like, for example, when the surveillance increased on men. Naturally, the trend was to have women now to carry out these activities so that they can bypass this surveillance. Women are more often looked from a passive view of not being violent. So when they carry out activities, it's a shocking thing. And also, women and girls can perform many activities in their traditional roles and at the same time as in their combatant roles. Like in the camps, they can be cleaning, cooking, and can be combatants also. They can also be sent to Kenya to gather information or find certain things. And they play a very important role in logistic support, like hiding members in their houses or weapons. They also become important in fundraising efforts to recruit other women and men, mainly because of their social interaction skills and their pivotal positioning in families and the community. So women play a very important role in those contexts.
Could you explain a bit about how you go about this research?
It was very important for me to understand the person from their own cultural context. So I started with observing terror suspect trials. Then I used to go and talk to the parents, then ask for permission. Some would give, some won't give. Once you get a startup interview, you don't directly ask questions. You just build the trust until the person itself feels like they are ready to talk to you. And I had to stay long periods of time in these communities so that I understand their perspective better.
So you've built up this group of around 36 women that you've interviewed, and you've written a number of academic papers about them. But your most recent paper has focused on women who joined the Al-Shabaab voluntarily. Can you explain what is the difference between a voluntary and an involuntary reason for joining?
When you look into voluntary recruitment, I look into it as women who join out of their sheer will. So this can be based because of they like the Al-Shabaab ideology. Or sometimes we have even women who go because of group belongingness, that you feel like it is a Muslim group, you have to be part of it, or you have joined with a friend. So those are mainly the voluntary aspect. Then you have the involuntary recruitment. That is when women and girls are forced to join these networks, or those who join the groups are joining because of particular deceptive or intimidation strategies used by the Al-Shabaab network.
You had these 36 women, and then you picked up 16 of them who you can categorize as women who'd voluntarily joined the group. Can you explain what the main factors were for those women?
When I made the selection of these 16, those are the women who were mainly inclined on building a caliphate, the ones who were completely resonating with the ideology of the Al-Shabaab. They are very minority, but they play a very important role because they have prominent positions in the network because of their ideological resonance. Then you have another group that might join because of particular anger involved, like maybe they want to get revenge from the state. So because you're not strong as an individual, now you feel like joining the Al-Shabaab as a revenge motive. Then you have the third one, which I consider as the majority. So the third one is mainly in line with the circumstances based on their daily interactions with the family, or you could the peers. Now, these relationships are very important because as a woman growing up in a patriarchal setting, maybe in particular dependency relationships, like you're dependent on your husband or a male relative, or it can be the aspect of she's really in love with him, so she doesn't want to lose him, or maybe because she's scared she may not have a man. And, you know, it also comes back to the economics with children. So sometimes you make your decision based on these dependency relationships. Seems like you're volunteering, but it has been shaped because of your family, your circumstances, or you want to be the obedient wife. So that is mainly the majority. And then you have the fourth one, which is mainly focused on the camp. That is, your voluntariness was based on the time you spent in the camp, the ideological trainings you underwent in the camp. Maybe you joined involuntarily, but because of the ideological training that has been constantly given to you in the camp, now you have the voluntariness based on trainings you undergo.
And I wonder what significance you're your findings have for Kenya in particular, the counterterrorism strategies and policies that the government is trying to put in place?
What I would say is the study would be more significant in preventing and countering violent extremism, because the study tries to understand and place the role of women or in radicalization and recruitment. But first, we should acknowledge there is a problem. Second, when you look into the topic of women in de-radicalization, disengaging or reintegration, it's important to have this gendered angle, because what fits men may not fit women. Then what measures can we take when you are trying to prevent women getting into these networks, whether it is voluntary or involuntary? Then also, when it comes to voluntary, mainly with ideology, how can we respond to these ideological tenets that facilitate voluntary recruitment, like, for example, misinterpreted Quranic verses? So those are some of the discussions we need with these young women, girls, so that they understand before they make a decision. So it comes back into these life skills, critical thinking, decision-making type of interventions that are needed.
Just finally, what are you working on next? Are you still interviewing these women, or are you moving to look at other issues with Al-Shabaab?
I'm still working with these women, mainly in line with the reintegration processes, but I'm also working on the topic of boys, that is the topic of masculinities, radicalization and recruitment with boys and men, to see whether recruitment pathways are changing and whether these trends are different for men and women.
Okay, well, we'll look forward to reading about that in the future. Thank you very much, Fatima. It's been fascinating talking to you.
Thank you too for having me.
You can read an article by Fatima with more details about her research by clicking the link in the show notes. That's it for this week. Thanks to all the academics who've spoken to us for this episode.
And many thanks to the conversation editors, Adeju Onshoyinka, Caroline Southey, Julius Meina, Brian Keel and Stephen Kahn for their help with this episode.
And thank you to Alice Mason, Imriel Morgan and Sherry White for our social media promotion.
If you want to learn more about any of the things we talk about on the show today, there are links to further reading in the show notes, where you can also find a link to sign up to our free daily email.
You can find us on Twitter at @TC_audio, on Instagram at theconversation.com, or email us on podcast@theconversation.com. The Conversation Weekly is co-produced by Mend Marawani and me, Gemma Ware, with sound design by Eloise Stevens. Our theme music is by Nita Sal.
And I'm Wale Fatade from Lagos, Nigeria. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, welcome, welcome back to Amandla here at CQT 90.3 on your FM dial. We are broadcasting today from Montreal. And Gwen, what's going on in Chad?
Well, we're about to discover that with a couple of pieces that we're going to be playing. These are rebroadcasts from Al Jazeera. Frankly, we try not to do that often on Amandla, but we thought tonight this would be appropriate. So we have two pieces that kind of nicely cover the situation. I mean, it was the president, Idriss Déby, who had been in power for 30 years, had just been reelected for a sixth term under very, very tense conditions in the country. Certainly not, was not going to be a popular sixth term, let's put it that way. But it's not going to pass, because shortly thereafter, he was killed in conflict, in his conflict-ridden country. So not a lot known yet about the circumstances of his death, if it was a directed killing and assassination, or if he got caught up in the armed conflict that is raging there. But in any event, he is no more. So we listened to two people. One is Al Jazeera's correspondent from Nigeria, who talks about the regional implications of this further destabilization of Chad. That's Ahmed Idriss, who tells us about that. And then they shift over to an interview with Marie-Roger Bilois, located in Paris. Very interesting conversation about how this is not necessarily bad news for France-Afrique. So France's entrenched interests in Chad. Idriss Déby was an ally. Well, it seems that some of the rebels operating in Chad have stepped up fairly quickly and said, hey, we can be your friends too. So interesting little piece. We hope to bring you some Amandla homegrown analysis sooner rather than later. But for now, this is Al Jazeera's take.
Thanks, Gwen. Stay tuned.
I want to bring in Amid Idris, who's live for us in Abuja, has been covering this region for us for many years. The Western countries have often seen Idris Deby as really a key ally in the fight against armed groups like Boko Haram, for example, and of course now the Front for Change in Concord in Chad. What do you think is going to be the impact of this news on the security situation in the region?
Well, basically, Rob, let's start with Chad itself. Now succession battle starts. Constitutionally, the Speaker of Parliament is supposed to take over if the President is indisposed. Now, whether or not that will happen, it remains to be seen, because this is a country that is that has seen a lot of coups, a lot of rebellions internally within its own military, and of course the rebellion in the north as well. Now, regionally, Chad is involved in peacekeeping operations or operations against armed groups in the Lake Chad region, in Central Africa, and other parts of the region as well. So Chad, for many countries in the region, is an important ally in the fight against extremist groups or armed groups that have been operating in that region. For example, Chad played a critical role in displacing Boko Haram from its territory last year after an operation led by the president himself, just like the way he did in the north. He led a force that dislodged Boko Haram fighters and ISWAP fighters from the Lake Chad region, freeing the territory of Chad of these attackers. And he's been a crucial partner for Nigeria. A lot of Chadian forces are currently part of the multinational joint task force, working in Nigeria, working in Niger, working in parts of Cameroon, as well as other parts of the region, to keep ISWAP and Boko Haram away. This will mean a very, very tense situation for the region, especially countries that are struggling to deal with these armed groups. So it's very, very critical now, whoever succeeds Chad or President Idris Deby should quickly address the issue or the vacuum that may likely arise in the incidence of his death now. Mm. So Nigeria, for example, I know is very worried. It needs to handle the situation very, very well. Currently, we've seen an uptick in violence in the Lake Chad region, bordering Chad, as well as parts of the northeast of Nigeria. Apart from Nigeria, Chad, Niger Republic also is dealing with an uptick in violence crossing from Mali into Niger, from Burkina Faso, and Cameroon also has its own share of violence in the recent past. So this is a very, very tense moment for all countries in the region that have, in one way or the other, relied on Chad for collaboration in dealing with armed groups in the region.
Mm. You were talking there, Ahmed, about the succession process, but we're just seeing on Chad TV that the army is being quoted as saying that a military council is going to be handling that transition. Now, given the fact that people in Chad had really hoped that this was going to be the end of a fairly prolonged political process and a fairly strenuous one, how do you think that that news is going to go down?
For the politicians, it's a very, very heavy blow to democracy. Whether or not President Idris Deby was a dictator, whether or not he manipulated the electoral system, that could spell a very, 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 very lethal blow to democracy in that country. These army, in a region where military coups are so prevalent in the recent past, this could mean that Chad will have to wait a long time for it to return to democracy fully. We suspect that this could take probably 3-4 years, unless, of course, there is international pressure to hand over to a democratically elected government or some form of a transitional civilian administration in the region. But for democracy in Chad, that should be, or that will be, on hold for many who know the way things work in that country.
Ahmed, I know we're going to be coming back to you in the next few hours as we get more information about what's going on. But for now, Ahmed Idris, thank you very much indeed. I want to bring in Marie Roger-Balewa. She's the president of Africa International Media Group, and she's joining us now from Paris. Thank you very much indeed for being with us. What does this news mean for the region, but for Chad particularly?
Well, first of all, it's a shock. You know, it's just after an election where he decided his won election overwhelmingly, and he seemed to be not removable because of his life insurance, which seemed to be the French support, and there are French troops in Chad, and these troops have saved him in the past, and you know he has grown very repressive. The electoral campaign was very violent, and I think some people will, in this moment, remember that the Idriss Deby's troops and police surrounded the home of an opponent and killed his mother. So something which was regarded as doom, as no good sign for Deby, that he will not get away with it in a way. That was something very special. And what happens now is, what I think of is that the fact, this Front pour l'Alternance et Concorde au Tchad, this rebellion group, was very clever to say immediately 2 days ago, while struggling and fighting in the front of Canaan, that they will not withdraw from the politics. They will not withdraw from the three border area, which means they will continue to back Barkhane, to work with the French for security in Sahel, and to show that Idriss Deby is not the only possible ally with France. This was very clear. And so this, for the French part, will not be, the death of Idriss Deby will not be a very severe blow because of that. And as a matter of fact, he was very weak in his country. People were opposing him broadly, even if he says he won election. But he knows, and people observing knew that he has lost part of his grip of the country, so that we will find out exactly how he died, because this is quite strange. It doesn't look like an accident, so we will find out later. But I think the first reaction here is in France, on the part of those who work with Chad, is not very appalled. They are not very much appalled. I think they have taken contact already with the rebels. Let me
ask you about some news that we're just getting out of Chad at the moment. We understand that you may have heard me mention before that Chad TV had been quoting the army as saying that a military council was going to be put in place to handle the transition. We're now hearing that General Mahamat Kaka, the son of the deceased Chadian leader Idriss Deby, is named as interim head of state. Now, Ahmed Idriss was telling us before, our correspondent was saying, that this was the imposition of a military council was going to be very concerning for the people of Chad. Do you think that, given the fact that this man is Idriss Deby's son, is going to go some way to alleviate those concerns?
Well, the main concern here is, somebody said that before, that the democratic process will be derailed. This is always a danger. We see what is happening in Mali. It's very difficult, very tough to get the military to hand over the power back to civilians. And they are struggling with it. We don't know how we'll be in Mali. And now in Chad, this opens a very critical period for what we call democracy for civilians. And you see that the most rebels are basically from the larger area of Idriss Deby. They have been very active all those years. Some are very close, like his nephew, who turned rebel against him. And there are many, many people who are very close let's say, from the family in terms of family relationship. But nobody will know now what if it will be sort of a progress for the country. Mm. But it's just a very critical and delicate situation.
Marie-Roger Beloa, we appreciate you joining us on Al Jazeera. Thank you very much indeed.
For Chad's new military government, this wasn't the start they were hoping for. 1 week after they seized power, young Chadians on the streets setting bonfires and blocking highways. At the heart of this protest is an opposition to military takeover.
We are tired of monarchy in Chad. We just want France to free us from this problem.
The response of the security forces was swift and harsh. Hours later, military ruler General Mohamed Idriss Déby appeared on national television to deliver what seemed to be a speech prepared to calm local and international concerns about the military's intervention in Chad.
These values, so dear to our late president, will be demonstrated and enshrined in the framework of an inclusive national dialogue that will be organized during this transition period. I will be the guarantor of this dialogue, which will not shy away from any subject of national interest according to a precise timetable that the government will be called upon to reveal.
He also said Chad needs international support to defeat groups trying to destabilize the country.
The protest came a week after the military takeover was given some support by Chad's allies. That has now put France in an awkward position after the crackdown on demonstrators by security forces.
The French President Emmanuel Macron, whose attendance at late President Idriss Déby's funeral was criticized as an endorsement of the military's takeover, condemned the use of force on demonstrators.
Let me be very clear. I gave my support to the integrity and the stability of Chad very clearly in N'Djamena. I support peaceful, democratic, inclusive transition. I do not support a plan of succession, and France will never be on the side of those who formed this plan.
For now, the streets of N'Djamena are calm, but there are fears it won't remain that way, with the opposition vowing to keep up its campaign against the military regime. Ahmed Idriss, Al Jazeera, N'Djamena.
Welcome once more, ladies and gentlemen, friends and comrades, to Amandla here at CQUT 90.3. We have brought you this edition from Montreal this week. And Gwen, what's up?
Well, that's it. I think it's time to say goodbye. And please say hello to Jazz Euphorium now. Africa unite, Batsilelele.
Good evening. You're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from drama to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between. I'm your host, Sarah DeA, recording from home on Thursday, April 29th, 2021. On tonight's show, my guests. Dean Patrick Fleming directs Every Brilliant Thing at the Siegel Center.
The fact that depression can be normal, and in some ways sadness is normal, and that it's okay, and that in a way you're not there to beat it, but that you can acknowledge the feelings you're having no matter what they are.
Daphne Laurendeau performs with her dance and life partner in On the Matter of Flowers.
We wanted to give a show that you have contact, since that's what we're missing at the moment, like to touch people, to hug, to like even just to breathe next to someone. It's kind of a different way of doing it right now. So that's what we wanted with that show. So the fact that Danny and I have no limit of touching, being close, it was allowing that thing to happen in the show.
And Louise Michelle Jackson on drawing inspiration from nature documentaries for Bright Worms.
I listen or I watch all the documentaries on bioluminescence. And I got like, again, when I felt very bad at this dark moment in my life, I think the only thing that could calm me or like make me feel better was to watch these creatures on the screen, you know? And it was a way for me to like hypnotize myself and take a distance.